This podcast is presented by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, safer, healthier people.
Thank you very much, Renata. And for all of you in the audience, this is going to be a low intellectual burden talk, so just sit back and kind of enjoy the next few minutes, and not too much in the way of heavy lifting. But this certainly can be an interactive session. Feel free to add any insights, comments, questions as we go on. And I'd like to begin by asking, I'm sure we have many bright young consumers in the audience, but can anyone tell me what this actually is? It's actually the most successful commercially deployed robotic device in the history of the field, and it is a robot. Anyone have any ideas? Exactly, it's a vacuum cleaner. It's the Roomba created by iRobot, and this has really served to introduce robotics to the vast majority of Americans. Although, as we'll soon see, robotics have really pervaded an astounding array of applications, not only in industry, but also in healthcare and medicine in particular. And so, if we're going to talk about robots, it's going to be helpful to really understand the field that we're going to be traversing. And historically, the term has been very loosely used. And one can conceive of a robot as really any sort of machine that has some sort of programmable aspect. Today, we tend to consider a robot to be really any device that has both electrical and mechanical components. And today, I think we tend to think of robots as having not only effectors and sensors, but also some degree of autonomy as well. And to really kind of give your bird's eye view of how we can conceive of robots, we can think of robots in the way that they're controlled, that is, whether or not they have some degree of independence, or whether they're completely directed by some external control, whether that be automated or human, as well as the ways in which they can function. And we will see a variety of robots that have a human shape and form. That was certainly the first foray into robotics in very ancient times, and even today. But I think increasingly we're moving towards a more utilitarian sort of effector-based model of how we can conceive of robots. And then in terms of their applications, and we'll see a variety of those. And if we think of robots or automata as being a very broad-based field, really the underpinnings of automata develop from a dependence on a single programming language, really, to help control these devices. And one can reach back all the way to 500 BC when Panini, who was a famous grammarian, actually developed some very, very simple rules that really are the precursor to almost every modern programming language. And through the intervening years, there were actually several attempts at the creation of devices that might be considered robots. We had the invention of the first wooden pigeon. There were numerous case reports of a wondrous musical making set of devices that entertained the Chinese emperors. And in 1200 AD, we see really the first autonomous robotic clock, which was really pioneered and spearheaded by numerous Arab inventors. And fast-forwarding to the time of Da Vinci, we really see the advent of the humanoid robot. And This robot was actually never constructed, but is actually being studied today in numerous Italian universities, and there has been a proposal to actually construct a working model of Da Vinci's famous humanoid design. It actually is really remarkable in numbers of, for example, degrees of freedom which the limbs allow, and is remarkably versatile in terms of its design. I think the only limitation is that the devices Da Vinci conceived is extremely heavy. It's something like 3 tons, and so unless you build it really out of a super lightweight aircraft aluminum or something, it's going to be extremely difficult to actually realize Da Vinci's vision. Actually, this is a 3-foot-tall wooden monk, which was created in Germany. And this was a favorite pastime of some of the religious figures of the time, who were really kind of the academics of their day. And this monk actually bows down and prays at regular intervals. And it was thought that this was actually used to help direct prayers and direct the activities of lay people when monks were otherwise indisposed. In the 1700s, I won't even attempt to pronounce this, but I think Karakuri Ningyo, well, I just did, so I'm sorry if I butchered that, but was actually an art which developed around the idea of automated puppetry. And today you can even see vestiges of that in Vietnam with the underground water puppets, which are operated on a crank-based system. And then in the 1700s, we actually have the evolution of the field to help actually within instruction. And this mechanical bird actually was fabled to be able to consume food, to be able to flap its wings, and help budding aviators understand how birds could fly. It was moderately successful in terms of its public popularity, but was definitely an advance in terms of the science. And then moving to the last century, we can see the Unimate here, which was really one of the first automated robots that helped General Electric to produce light bulbs after in the post-war era, and actually helped catapult General Electric to the top of its industry segment. They were really one of the first companies to embrace robotics. And then the academics, particularly at Stanford and out west, helped to expand the use of these devices. And one of the first robot-controlled arms was then later employed in manufacturing processes. In the 70s, we saw the advent of independent navigation with what was essentially a camera-based device that provided some feedback to a glorified cart, and was actually called the Stanford cart. And in the 90s, we saw really kind of probably the low point of the first farting robot. Oh, there it is. Named Choo Choo, who actually produced its own gas for propulsion, and thankfully this hasn't become too popular. and today we can see that there are numerous devices. This is actually one of the industrial robots that's used in Germany, and you can see the articulating arm actually has many more degrees of freedom than a human hand, and so we've actually moved beyond replicating human form and human function, and had begun to use these robots in situations that are that humans simply could not, in which humans simply could not be employed. So robots have begun not only to replace humans, but actually to sort of transcend what they can accomplish. And why is this important? And why in particular are we focused on the application of these devices in medicine? Well, it's becoming big business, so to speak. In terms of government funding, there are nearly $300 million, which have already been allocated the last year that statistics were available, which were 2003, and that number has only increased in the interim. And in addition, there are numerous bills pending in Congress which, from a national security and from a public health aspect, are aiming to increase the number of ways in which robots can be employed and deployed. And in fact, we, as a nation, spend a relative paucity of our research and development funding in electronics, and the EU and Singapore in particular are actually taking the lead in these areas. So this is becoming an international endeavor. And the way that we're going to kind of conceive of medical robotics in this talk is from three major major realms. The first is sort of the hospital-based inpatient as well as the outpatient setting. The second is in terms of biosecurity, and the third is in terms of the basic science aspects. And many people are not even aware, but robots play a very important role in not only the clinical setting, but also cellular level work. And in particular, robots are instrumental in DNA sequencing work. The Human Genome Project actually would not have been possible. The completion of that would not have been possible without the use of hundreds and hundreds of robots that help to prepare cell samples as well as continue sequencing. Robots are also now being used in cell culture, and this has important implications as we begin, for example, with rapid mass-scale vaccine development. Many vaccines actually depend on the use of either egg ova or rat or hamster kidney cells and so forth as a substrate in which we can grow virus. And these are actually relatively labor-intensive and low-yield steps. And through the use of automated devices, we actually have the potential to increase the efficiency and rate of production of vaccines by up to 10 or 20-fold by some estimates. And so this can be very, very important from a public health standpoint. We even now have robots that are able to manipulate single cells. For example, there have been proposals to use them in vitro fertilization to help decrease the level of result in defective embryos that are produced as a result of manipulation errors. Now, clinically, where we're seeing a lot of the sort of interest and excitement form is in the realm of the operating room and the inpatient ward. Really, this all began in the early 80s with the first and very brave use of robots in brain biopsies. And essentially, in a brain biopsy, a patient is placed within the bore of a CT scanner, and the lesion is localized. And in a prior era, even today, a surgeon or radiologist will actually take a long catheter and place that within the brain and try to essentially characterize where that lesion is in three dimensions. And it's actually a relatively challenging task. This is also the same which is done for lung biopsies and all other sorts of small procedures. The advantage of using a robot is that it already knows what the registration cues are coming from the image data set. So really you only need to make one pass and you can be assured that you're getting into the center of the lesion. You can greatly increase the yield of a biopsy. If any of you have ever had or someone you know has had a breast biopsy, for example, you know this is entirely possible to go through the entire procedure, all the emotional aspects, and a small degree of medical risk as well, only to receive necrotic tissue, which is not able to be characterized pathologically, and then you have to go back for another procedure. Well, using something like an automated CT-guided biopsy regime, you can dramatically decrease the levels, theoretically, of false negative biopsies. In the intervening years, we saw the evolution and application of robots in everything from orthopedic to prostate surgery. In 2001, the Zeus device, which you see here, was actually first used to perform the removal of a gallbladder, which is really a landmark event. And essentially, the surgeon was able to use a micromanipulator arm on both sides, along with a couple of screens, and kind of direct what is considered a pinhole surgery or laparoscopic surgery. And this created a tremendous amount of excitement in the field. Sorry, this is out of order, but again, we see the use of robotics in terms of cell culture and PCR. In terms of other inpatient applications, robots have a tremendous role to play and tremendous potential role to play in terms of the dispensation of medications in the inpatient ward. It's been estimated there are billions and billions of prescriptions written each year. However, we have a tremendous shortage of pharmacists that are skilled and able to fulfill that need. And as we know, in the famous National Academy of Sciences report, to err is human. Up to a significant percentage of medication errors are due to human error and dispensation error. And using a robot such as the Autoscript or the IntelliFill system, you can actually increase efficiency. A human might be able to fill maybe something like 100 prescriptions an hour. And what that entails is actually checking the prescription, making sure that the medication is appropriate for the patient's body habitus, for example. Some medications need to be scaled by weight. You need to make sure that there aren't any interactions. In addition, you need to make sure that you can drop the device, drop the medication in an appropriate amount of saline if it's an injectable form, or that you need to dispense the appropriate number of pills if it's in a tablet form. And then you need to actually make sure that the prescription actually gets to the patient. So there are a lot of places, a lot of potential breaks in the chain. And, you know, you might be able to fill 100 prescriptions an hour if you're a very competent, capable pharmacist. A machine such as the Autoscript can actually verify prescriptions, verify dosage, and provide, and essentially this is an arm that sort of articulates around a huge bay that contains thousands and thousands of medications. Actually was able to lift up the appropriate number of medications, suck out the appropriate number of pills, place it into a specialized container for a patient, and then actually in some cases, as we'll see, place the container within a robot, which then goes to, within a mobile robot, which actually goes to the patient ward. So a human actually never touches the prescription ever. And in this case, you can fill something like 1,000 prescriptions an hour. So we're talking about a significant a significant increase in efficiency as well as decrease in potential medical errors. And this is exactly the kind of device that is able to take a prescription or any other sort of small containerized item to and from patients. And this is called the HealthMate system. There are about 100 in use today. It's estimated that a hospital can actually recoup the cost of one of these devices within 6 months of its deployment. And these are really autonomous small devices that navigate hallways. They're very polite. They say, "Excuse me, sir, I need to move," or I need to make my way through. And they coexist perfectly with the rest of the medical staff. And they serve essentially as glorified couriers, and they free up individuals and skilled labor to do other tasks. They also help prevent the abuse of medications. So, for example, in order to remove a medication from this item, from this device, you might actually need to place your fingerprint on a thumbprint sensor, and so that only your medication will come out of this device. And for example, if you have a controlled substance that's being administered, you might actually require a nurse as well to have their thumbprint registered. So this actually has several applications in the clinical setting. And then, as we'll see later, immediately following this talk, a live demonstration. These are some photos cribbed from the InTouch website of a device that's being deployed in clinical settings to help kind of change the paradigm for how medical care is really delivered from a rounds perspective and from a patient assessment perspective. Additionally, within the field of medical education, we also see an increased use of robots. The way that a lot of medical education is conducted today, basic procedures are often conducted in either inanimate models, animals such as porcine or pig models, or even dogs and rabbits, or on volunteers, on humans who might volunteer, for example, to undergo a prostate exam. And for reasons that are understandable, there are not too many volunteers for those sort of activities. And number two, it's not quite as realistic to work on an inanimate model to, for example, intubate a patient or to insert IV lines. And so robots have actually been developed that have human-like skin, have vessels that can be punctured, that actually can develop arrhythmias, that have various types of heartbeats that can help to direct students. And actually, I wrote here that there's a $100,000 cost for this one robot that comes from McMaster University in Canada. There's a more recent version, which has been deployed in Korea, which costs on the order of $10,000. And so we're rapidly moving towards a time and a place where these are actually going to be something that's practical for medical education. Now, moving back to the surgical suite, why even consider using robots? Well, robots are really not necessarily a replacement for a surgeon, but in many ways an augmentation for what a surgeon can do. A surgeon often has, during pinhole or so-called laparoscopic surgery, very limited views. What you're doing is using a trocar. Now, this is a robot with three independent articulating arms, but in lieu of this device, you actually have three or four medical students or assistants holding trocars or long catheters that contain a camera or scissors or a small laser. And essentially the surgeon is forced to use that small window, that small viewport, to kind of visualize the entire abdomen or the lungs or whatever field that he might be working in. And robots can actually help to address a limited field of view by the use of multiple independent arms that can help to provide a 3D stereoscopic view for the surgeon. So it actually looks extremely realistic and provides a larger field of view. In addition, the human arm and human controlled instruments actually have a limited number of degrees of freedom. So you might be able to move an arm in, out, rotate or twist, but let's say, for example, you have a lesion that's behind the heart. You're going to actually have to move the heart anteriorly or posteriorly or displace it somehow in order to get behind the heart to for example, remove a tumor. Well, using a robot, you can actually use a device that can articulate and move in different ways that a human arm can't. And so this is actually very promising. This is probably one of the most important ways in which robots can help us in the operating room. There's also a reduced need for human intervention, and in addition, it actually helps the surgeon to endure a long procedure. A long neurosurgery might last anywhere from 8 to 9 to 10. Some surgeries even last 12 hours, and to be standing all that time is technically difficult. And so actually now what you see here is a Da Vinci automated robotic system with the surgeon actually sitting within this 3D stereoscopic viewport. And so actually the surgeon is looking entirely within this set of 3D glasses. His arms are controlling two robotic manipulators. He still needs a couple of assistants to help place the robotic arms over the patient. And then the rest of the sterile field is very similar to that used in conventional laparoscopic surgery. The Da Vinci system has actually been used in upwards of 20,000 procedures a year, so it's actually being used quite effectively. Each unit costs around $1,200,000, and there are over 300 in use worldwide. And there have actually been numerous procedures that have been conducted with the Da Vinci system. What you can see here is again the system, which is draped in a sterile cloth. The one of the articulating arms, and you can see that it has as many degrees of freedom as a human hand, and in some cases even more. These are the viewports in which the hands are placed, and they provide a surgeon with a very similar feel to that of conventional instruments. And in fact, let's see, you can actually even... She's long. Let's see if we can. Don't know if our technical wizards have any advice here. Let me. Here we go. All right, I'm not sure if this how well this projects, but essentially what you're seeing is a surgeon using this two-handed device and actually sewing together a blood vessel, likely within the inner portion of the chest. And you can see it's actually extremely realistic, and the view that the surgeon gets is actually a three-dimensional view. So it looks very much like you're manipulating this, that you're actually sort of seeing the results of your work, and it's actually extremely satisfying to work in a setting like this, because you actually receive sort of instantaneous tactile feedback as well, and so you can actually feel the vessel going, the needle going through the vessel using a force feedback net mechanism. If any of you use it, have had a chance to play around with the new Sony PlayStation, they use a very similar technology. So, you know, the evolution of technology, it's always good. And so moving on, really, as I said, the Da Vinci has been used in numerous settings, anywhere from heart surgery. And if any of you have had a relative that has had coronary artery bypass, they're actually now, in many cases, eligible to have this done laparoscopically instead of having an open heart surgery. Instead of cracking the chest, you make a few pinholes. And in many cases, they're able to reduce the hospital stay, reduce the morbidity, and reduce the level of pain that they experience. We're actually now encroaching on an era when we can even do heart valve replacements through a robotic laparoscopic approach. And this is really a revolution, and considering that, for example, the patent foramen ovale or ventricular septal defects that can be repaired endoscopically are the most common congenital heart defect. The range of applications is extremely broad. And as you know, prostate cancer is also extremely is an extremely morbid condition in many cases. Up to 80% of individuals at the age of 80 will have prostate cancer, and if you live to the age of 89, you have a 90 to 95% chance of developing prostate cancer. So for many of the gentlemen here, you're guaranteed to get it if you live long enough. And unfortunately, most people who undergo prostatectomy at the current time emerge either impotent or incontinent. And so those are two very poor choices to have to face. If you leave prostate cancer in place, there's controversy, but the typical time course is bony metastatic disease and a very, very painful course. So for those who do face the prospect of prostatectomy, the use of a robot to help delineate very delicate neurovascular structures and to help avoid incontinence and avoid impotence potentially is extremely compelling. And really, what's the evidence? I mean, talk about the potential, but have there been any studies? And in fact, there have. And in prostatectomy in particular, there's actually a small cost premium for using a robot. And most of that is probably related to the time premium in terms of setup and sort of the sunk cost draping the device. But that is being reduced as people become more proficient with the machine. There have also been other studies that have shown that in many cases, robotic surgery is comparable in terms of outcome to that of conventional surgery. And in fact, there are a series of studies that demonstrate really that in many cases, the level of morbidity or side effects that you experience from undergoing robotic surgery is minimal. And really, the only that I'd like to draw your attention to is a couple of cases of gastric perforation, which you can experience in almost any type of laparoscopic surgery. And furthermore, a few technical errors, a few technically related challenges, which are being worked through as physicians become more competent with the device. Now, in terms of other settings, in terms of outpatient settings, we can see the use of robots. This is actually a robot developed at MIT to help with stroke patients, and a patient actually presents with, for example, arm hemiparesis, paralytic, or lack of use of the arm. They can actually place their arm on this device and then watch a screen, which helps to guide them through the use of that arm. And studies have actually shown that if patients receive this sort of care or some sort of physical therapy within 30 days of a stroke, that their level of reuse of that limb improves by 8 to 9 times. And unfortunately, many, many, many people who have strokes do not receive this kind of care because it's extremely expensive and labor intensive to provide it. So the deployment of robots in an outpatient setting can be extremely potentially valuable. Now, in terms of home care, this is another area in which demographic shifts are actually kind of providing impetus for actually commercial companies to help move into this space, particularly in Japan, where you have the burden of an aging population and a younger population that is often wedded to their workplace and does not necessarily have time or even the resources to provide full-time care for their parents. And so these are actually devices that are being deployed in Japan and Korea. This one is actually a sort of very glorified walking chair. And then, of course, we've all seen the Aibo robot, which unfortunately has been discontinued by Sony. But that was sort of a very early attempt to sort of move robots into the home. There are also robots, we've heard about the robotic cat, but there are also other robots that can help children, for example, to help children recognize emotions. This is the cat which Dr. Libin has helped to develop. There's the emu, which helps children develop cognitive language as well as facial recognition skills. And then we have robots in an area which I'm personally involved in, which is the use of robots in imaging. And robots not only replace humans in terms of courier tasks, but robots can be used, for example, in ultrasound. And if any of you have seen the spectacular three-dimensional pictures of babies in third trimester ultrasounds, those are actually kind of technically challenging to produce. And so essentially what we're able to do is using robots, use three-dimensional rastering arms that can help relieve some of the sonographic burden. And actually we can achieve pictures which are really dramatic and help to reduce the rate of repetitive strain injury in sonographers, which is actually the number one occupational hazard in that area. We actually also have the use of robots, and here's one of the CT-guided biopsies that we talked about before, in everything from bowel imaging. If any of you have ever had a colonoscopy, the prospect of having a creeping robot creep through your colon actually might seem pretty reasonable. And we actually have the use of robots, for example, in oncology. This is one of the first. It's called the CyberKnife. It's used in brain cancer surgery routinely. It shoots a series of gamma rays to help localize tumors and can actually help treat cancers that were otherwise unresectable. And then we have the use of MRI-compatible robots, non-ferromagnetic robots that can use, for example, in breast biopsies, ablation, and even through the use of electroporetic methods, new sorts of drug delivery. Unfortunately, we're running short of time, so I'll quickly run through the rest of these. The other areas in which robots are being deployed medically is in terms of the battlefield. And we've seen actually at a prior Future of Health Technology Summit, a device called the Bear, which was designed to help move patients from the battlefield where, and basically it's sort of like this, it's essentially a device that helps to carry individuals using a gyroscopic mechanism. I'll move forward. And in other areas, we have the use of microrobots in surveillance in areas in which humans can't reach. This is actually a robot that's that was deployed for a NASA mission, which has now been redeployed in airports to help monitor people who are moving in and out of smaller airports. We also have the use of humanoid robots, which have had a mixed degree of success. The Asimo, which was pioneered by Honda, had some dramatic failures as well as successes. And this was actually just a year after that very embarrassing public defeat. So we see that robots today actually have a pretty, So this is actually, fairly astounding in terms of its curb appeal. Quickly, robots can sing and dance, but what we're interested in medicine is the use of robots to help understand human movement. And this is a robot in Korea that actually uses gyroscopic load balancing to help physicians actually model human acrobatic behavior. And so we hope to use this, again, in physical therapy and regenerative and reparative settings as well. And unfortunately, I won't be able to move through the rest of these, but kind of the future of where this takes us, again, is in terms of augmentation. As we face an aging population, we're going to need robots to help people with not only failing limbs, but decreased levels of musculature and ability. And so all of these are actually sort of robotic exoskeletons or sort of second skins that help to develop it. This is actually a 100-pound bag of rice. And so this very slight young gentleman, probably not much bigger than me, is able to carry this without too much difficulty. And then taken to an extreme, I just thought I'd kind of end with a little bit of eye candy. This is kind of the Luke Skywalker version of where exoskeletons might lead us. But upfit that with a couple of guns, and you're going pretty far. But the challenges of where we go really are going to be in terms of some of the challenges that face the deployment of technology in general. And really, the promises are really quite broad. So as we begin to think about ways in which we can incorporate technology into our healthcare delivery system, it certainly would behoove us to save a very important and prominent role for autonomous systems. So thank you very much for your time. And we'll move on to our robotic demonstration next.
To access the most accurate and relevant health information that affects you, your family, and your community, please visit www.cdc.gov.